Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with the director of the Center for Professional Wellbeing, Dr. John Henry Pfifferling, about stories about physician stress, survival, and satisfaction. I think this is critically important, Christy.
I know. I'm looking forward to the conversation. But first, we have a couple research that matters and also a conversation with our Coast to Coast correspondent.
Yeah, we're going to have a busy first segment, and let's dive right in here about couch potatoes. Those who, I love that term. You like it? Yeah, like a potato that sits on the couch.
Yeah, and this is a study looking at people who spend more than 2 hours a day in front of a TV or computer, sitting on their couch or their computer chair, being at a higher risk for heart disease and early death.
Yeah, you know, unless, I think we should clarify, you know, it's not necessarily those who are just at work and you're in front of your, you know, your computer. I think this is really more than that. It's really also people who tend to be less sedentary. More sedentary, less active.
Yes.
And that really, you know, and this study that was in the Journal of American College of Cardiology, really significant impact.
So it was the first to examine this relationship between screen time and non-fatal or, you know, heart or problems that don't kill you, as well as heart
fatal
events that kill you.
Yeah, so they had a 48% increased risk of just dying if they spent 4 or more hours a day kind of in front of that computer, and 125% risk of just heart problems if they spend 2 or more hours a day, you know, going home at night and just kind of kicking off and sitting yourself in front of the TV.
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly we need to do more studies to try to figure out what it is about prolonged sitting. What does that do? Why is it that getting some exercise in the day didn't seem to make a big difference in this?
What if you got up every 10 minutes and,
right,
and ran to the refrigerator?
Sure.
I don't know. But what's the bottom line here, Christy?
The bottom line is that we should be active individuals and be cautious if you're spending more than 2 hours
watching,
a day in front of the TV.
If you're watching 3 football games a day on the weekends, it's probably too much.
It probably is. Okay, the next one is an interesting one about circumcision, preventing the most common sexually transmitted disease called HPV, that virus that causes genital warts or cervical cancer.
Yeah, you know, Christy, I know we've been looking to try to get one of the national experts on circumcision to really come in and really talk about what we perceive is to be changing data. And this is a great example, I think, of some research that came out in The Lancet this year, looking at not only HPV, that bad virus, and its relationship to circumcision among men, but also its transmission to women.
Yeah, so they looked at HIV-negative men. This was done in Uganda, and their female partners who did not have either HIV and also did not have this virus HPV, and followed them over time, and basically found that women who were with a male partner who was circumcised during that time, so an adolescent or adult circumcision done, had a lower risk of being infected with that high-risk HPV virus. And we know there's lots of there's been data over the last several years in Africa showing that adults and adolescent men who are circumcised are less likely to acquire HIV. So this is growing evidence that circumcision for adults may reduce the risk.
Yeah, and this doesn't eliminate the need to have safe sexual practices. It certainly does not, but it does add to what appears to be some really growing evidence about the benefits of circumcision in protecting against some of the common and also some of the most fatal sexually transmitted diseases.
I still think we can't generalize this to the United States population yet. A lot of this research, that we have to take it cautiously. These are adults getting circumcised with different amounts of disease in their area compared with the United States, where we circumcise babies. So it is very different. But I think it's more evidence, and we're learning.
And that's why we want to have an expert on here to have the conversation.
Absolutely.
Because it's a conversation we need to have with parents and our listeners. Well, we're real excited right now to also bring back to Research That Matters to talk about common issues affecting our listeners, our Coast to Coast correspondent, Dr. Peter Curtis. Welcome back to Your Health, Dr. Curtis.
Hello there. Good to talk to you.
Hello, across the country there.
You sound so close, hello, but we know you're so far.
Tell us, Dr. Curtis, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've been thinking about the time recently that I was overbilled by the hospital, and I was wondering how this kind of thing, how often it happens and how it might affect a lot of people and how people might not know they're being overbilled.
You mean overbilled, like you received a bill from the hospital and you looked at it and said, wait a minute, that's not right?
I said, oh, my God.
How much was it? Can you share? Or is that too personal? A lot?
I'll tell you the little anecdote. I was helping my son move his accommodation down in San Francisco, and I became very dizzy and ended up by going back to my family doctor, who said probably I needed to have a CT of the head.
A CAT scan of the head. Which is a CAT scan of the head.
Yeah, a CAT scan.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had the CAT scan. It took about 15 minutes, I think, all in all, at the hospital to which she is affiliated, my doctor's affiliated. And of course I get Medicare, but 4 weeks later, I received a bill for $6,000.
Wow.
I think by any standard of expense to surprise ratio, that's a surprise.
It is a surprise.
Were there additional things on the bill in addition to the CAT scan of your head, or was it just that said CAT scan, $6,000?
It's what's called a summary bill, which means you just get sent what was done, and not a list of things that were done, just one thing, you know, like CAT scan of head.
Uh-huh.
And you were summarily surprised. What were you surprised about?
Well,
besides the cost.
I thought it was
too much.
Out of the ballpark, way out.
What'd you do?
So I called up the radiology department at the hospital, and I asked them what an outpatient CT charge was. And the answer was $1,700.
So you gathered your facts before you called the insurance company?
Yes.
Well, not the insurance company, probably the hospital. Probably the hospital you called, right?
Pardon?
You called, then you had to call the hospital, didn't you?
I called the hospital, yeah.
Okay.
But I called the radiology department. I didn't call the billing department.
Uh-huh.
So the radiology department told it was $1,700. And then I went to the billing department, and I didn't call them. I went and saw them because I don't want to be pushed around all the time.
Christy and I do not want to push you either.
No, we don't. Wait, Dr. Curtis, did you tell them when you called radiology that you're a physician?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. So then you go down there.
That was some leverage.
Uh-huh.
So it transpired that I was charged an inpatient CAT scan fee, which is $6,000. And an outpatient CAT scan fee is $1,700.
Wow.
Because it takes another 5 minutes to wheel that patient over to CAT scan and wheel them back. So that extra 10 minutes is expensive.
Wow.
So then I asked my doctor why she had referred me for an inpatient CAT scan. And she said, well, I didn't know that there were any differences between CAT scans. And it's the hospital that decided where I was going to go to have my CAT scan.
Well, Dr. Curtis, we're going to have to wrap up in a minute or two, but how did the story end? Tell me it has a good ending.
Well, the good ending was is that they only charged $1,700, but it got me into looking up what people do about their hospital bills, and maybe I should tell you that about that some other time because I found out some interesting things.
Well, give us just a quick taste.
Well, a quick take is that 80% of all hospital bills are inaccurate.
Oh.
Wow.
And there are either duplications, there are procedures that are listed that haven't been done. And everybody should order or ask for an itemized and dated bill and look at it very carefully.
That's really good advice, because if you weren't a physician, you might not have known, and 6,000 and 1,700 is very different.
And the other thing is to avoid all what seem to be freebies, because, for instance, if they give you a toothbrush, or it's $750, and they may charge you for what is called a fog dispersal agent, which turns out to be a piece of gauze.
Wow.
And a mucus recovery system, which is $60, is a box of tissue.
Yeah, I'm not sure I wanted to even know that.
Wow.
Well, Dr. Curtis, this is amazing, and I think in the fact that you're a physician and could uncover this, uh-huh. but we have listeners who get hospitalization and hospital bills, and I think there is a take-home here, which is there is no free lunch.
Look
there is
at
no
your
free
bill.
Toothbrush.
Right.
And look at your bill. And if you have questions, ask.
Well, there are some people now who will look at it for you. You have to pay them. But online, there are a number of websites of people who are trained to look at hospital bills and help you.
Well, that's good to know.
Well, Dr. Curtis, we want to thank you. Difficult story, but a really important one. Thanks for telling your story with us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
As usual.
We'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show and our Coast to Coast correspondent conversation with Dr. Peter Curtis. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with the director for the Center of Professional Well-Being, Dr. John Henry Fifferling, about stories of stress, survival, and satisfaction.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. John Henry Fifferling about professional well-being, stories of stress, survival, and satisfaction.
Dr. John Henry Fifferling is one of the founders of the Center for Professional Well-Being, which is a nonprofit educational institution that provides support and solutions for reducing the stressors in professional life. We're so glad to have you with us, Dr. Fifferling.
Thanks, Christy. Great to be here.
You know, Dr. Fifferling, this is a really huge issue, and I think we've been around the margins of it, Christy and I, for 2 years when we talk about stories about that we hear from our listeners about encounters with physicians and other providers that are difficult. And I wonder, you know, this is such a huge area, this physician-patient dialogue and physicians that are suffering or having some difficulties. How did you yourself get interested in this whole topic?
Totally unplanned and unpredictable from what I was doing as an anthropologist.
You weren't born
at the
that
time.
Way.
I was sure not born. I was actually studying and living with chimpanzees in East Africa and working with Jane Goodall and my wife and I. And then I came back and by an unusual circumstance had an opportunity to study a bunch of neurologists, not expecting to look at people in our society as an anthropologist, and discovered all kinds of issues that I had no idea about in advance, and that led to more and more projects, basically 7 years of research studying.
Like what kind of things did you when you say that you didn't know in advance?
I didn't expect to discover the tremendous aloneness that physicians have, the expectations that were unrealistic, and how they tried to become real perfectionist-like to deal with the unrealistic expectations. I didn't expect to learn about the suffering and the drug and alcohol problems and the suicidal thoughts and the depression and particularly the burnout and the exhaustion. So that was all sitting there in front of me as I was collecting histories, following the doctors around for years and years and years. And as you do that as an anthropologist, in this case, the natives, or in our case, the natives, they pour their hearts out to you because you're not competing, you're not judging, you're not evaluating. you're not trying to one-up them, or you're not part of the media. You're not really a spy, even though some people perceive you are. And as you bond with the natives, you get closer and closer to them. And then so what happened with the center is I couldn't decide whether to continue the research because I felt it would just be more exposure to sadness and tiredness and fatigue and depression and burnout. And a bunch of my friends who were physicians at the time said, you can't continue the research. I didn't think it would all be the same as what I sort of felt, except different by specialty. Why don't you do something about it and stop being a researcher and get involved? Wow. And so that's the applied part of anthropology. You study the natives. Sometimes you discover their problems, and instead of just researching and writing about it for science, and which is valuable, you decide to get dirty.
So, I have to ask: are natives as physicians as interesting or more interesting to you than the chimpanzees?
Well, the classic comment, Christy, I get all the time when I'm being introduced at a talk on physician stress or something like that, is when you left chimps and you got to study docs, what was the difference? And I have a one-liner response that is, well, it was devolution versus evolution, and the chimps were really modeling evolution and adapting and changing, and the docs were more stuck. And I make a joke about it, but it makes it easier to talk about a taboo and scary topic to physicians, especially with my being brought in as kind of the authority on the dark side of medicine, and no longer run away and gloss over that real people are really hurting out there, and then they have tremendous responsibilities. And do you share or not share that with your patients or the public? I mean, do you tell a patient, I've got a bad cold, or I've got this infection, or this, or do you tell them you're depressed or you're on, or whatever? What do you do about that kind of thing? So it's an area that's pretty much unknown by all and covered up an awful lot by those in the profession. And it could be any other profession. There's similar things occur among attorneys or among judges. I'm very concerned about depression problems and suicidal problems among judges who've got never really know what the right stuff is and have to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. John Henry Pfefferling about professional well-being and stories, and we're hearing his story about getting interested in the diagnosis, treatment, evaluation, and really helping physicians who are suffering. I wonder if you can just...
Can I add one little piece, Adam, sure, to repeat what you said, Christy said, what you said? What happened to me is I unexpectedly kind of transformed myself from a researcher, scientist, to an advocate. Because there was so much empathy with following these lives for years, weeks, months, days, hours, et cetera. And so it really got to my soul. And without,
well, and
that's what happened to me,
Adam.
That's
exactly where I wanted to hear a little bit. I don't know if any story comes to mind in particular about, I know sometimes when I was a resident, hearing about my patients' difficulties sometimes was paralyzing till I developed some tools that allowed me to do something. And I'm wondering if maybe is there any story that resonates or some that resonate about hearing things and then ultimately when you developed the skills to do something that you might be able to share?
I mean, there's certain things that really pushed me to look both in the mirror and asked the question, is this my calling, which was the last thing I expected from being a grad student doing anthropology in different parts of the world. There are about two or three that really hit just at the moment. One was a physician who I was interviewing and following him around. I was a surgeon, and he poured out after a bunch of drinks late at night, because that's the chance I had to interview him, how he had planned to kill his wife's lover, who it turned out was one of his partners was involved. And I called up my grad student advisor at the time. This is my doctoral dissertation on physicians. And I said, this guy's just told me he's going to kill this other doctor. I know the whole story. Yes, the guy was inebriated, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't get trained with what to do in this situation. It's just like in field notes is, well, what do you really do? Yep. Maybe nobody else knows. We did a whole bunch of sort of longer talks I spent a lot of time with him trying to find out whether he was internally consistent, whether it was just hallucinating or imagining, but he really had a plan, et cetera, et cetera. And my advisor says, do what your heart tells you, get involved. And that was a very, very early beginning as I was doing my dissertation on physician response to change at the time. So that's one thing that really sort of began to turn me around. Then the research continued. And I remember being called into a family practice program to do a program on residency stress. And a couple of residents said, can I meet with you privately? And one of them told me about his anger and his dreams and his violence in his anger and how he was so sleep deprived that he didn't know what to do when he got home with his young baby and his wife, and the baby was driving him up the wall. And we tried to give him, I was collecting some data at the time and not meeting with him as a client or anything like that. And it was obvious to me that this guy had almost no control over his anger, and he was so sleep deprived. And I went to the chairman the next day and I said, I'm really worried. Take this guy off his block and get him some help because I don't know what's going to happen. And the guy said, sure, I'll help you. And I called him a couple of days later and I said, have you done anything about that particular resident? He said, well, I'll get to it. And then a month later, I got a call. The baby was screaming when he got home, and he just shook the baby, and then the baby died. Oh. He shook the baby so badly that the baby, in fact, died. And then
you had tried to intervene and had done what you really could do at that time.
So that's really shook me to my core, and it kind of exposed, how these difficult things are easier to run away from and not to get involved. And I don't make diagnosis. I just said, there's something really wrong. Please listen to me and do something. And then I, followed up. But so he went to jail, lost his license, of course, the marriage, of course, and the baby's dead. So that's never stopped resonating, if you wish, Adam, Christy.
And now you've taken that into a whole nother realm of your work and your life to really be dedicated to trying to help people before they get to that point or help intervene before those terrible things happen. We are going to have to take a little break, but we are grateful that you're here with us today. We're talking with Dr. John Henry Pfeifferling about stories of stress and survival and satisfaction. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the director for the Center of Professional Well-Being, Dr. John Henry Pfeifferling, and we've been talking a little bit about physician burnout and physician stress and sleep deprivation and really some profound stories that you've shared with us of where that's really gotten to an extreme circumstance. You know, I'm curious on your take about preventing burnout. We do some, in our teaching of young doctors at UNC Family Medicine, we have some professional development seminars about sort of the role of compulsiveness in the normal physician. There's this article from back in the early 1980s about this. It's beautifully written about this triad of guilt, doubt, and an exaggerated sense of responsibility. All three things that are important for doctors in some ways, but yet can really get us off into a downward spiral. How do you teach doctors about this or help prevent burnout in reflecting on this?
Well, let me get back to what you said about the triad. I mean, if I were being in the moment to teach something like that, I would be pushing for them to understand perfectionism, and we want to get away from disabling perfectionism. And so excellence is wonderful, superb care is wonderful, but when they move to unrealistic expectations, then—
You mean like I'm not going to make a mistake?
Like I'm not going to make a mistake when in fact the variables associated with whatever's going on at any one time in any situation, whether it's the OR or the office situation, the variables are just almost infinite. From the history and the biology and the patient and the staff and the system and everywhere else. And so how do you so most errors in fact are system problems. They're rarely an individual's problems per se, or it was an individual that nobody gave them feedback. So they couldn't learn from when they didn't know something and were put down by saying, I don't know. I mean, once upon a time somebody on a TV show, Donahue, in the old days. He said, well, if you had one thing to do to change medical student education, only one thing, the media, the TV media, what would you do? And I said, I would teach the students to be comfortable in saying, I don't know. And I would teach the faculty to be comfortable in saying, I know. And then let's move forward with that and learn from each experience and be in the moment and present and yet take advantage of what we do know and what makes sense and what's standardized and what's not standardized and move forward. But, but perfectionism is just the absolute killer. That's what the triad does to the individual.
So that's the thing that drives people off to drinking or to lead them to other things is some of this holding themselves to expectations that aren't.
Yeah, they put themselves on a pedestal that's so high they get evaluated and judged on such a high pedestal, and there's no leeway so that they don't stay open and flexible and don't see all whatever's going on as opportunities to learn and to feed it back into the system so we can make a difference, so we can have a more near perfect, not perfect, situation with less errors.
Well, I know that this saying, I don't know, is kind of paradigm shifting and has to be role modeled and accepted. And
Absolutely. Early
on in the first and second years, that's such a difficult concept because they're getting tested all the time. Say, I don't know is like, well, you're going to get a bad grade. But I also wonder, paradigm shifting, what I've heard you say earlier is that a lot of the problems facing physicians and health professionals and other disciplines are the same problems that affect all people, relationships, and problems with substance use and stress. And I wonder if this idea that I'm a physician, but I'm also a human being, how that plays out in your work. Do people see themselves as somehow different because they're a physician?
Well, the messages that our students, our trainees, our residents, and our physicians get from every level is that you're a doctor first, and the human components of you, your fallibility and your openness and your forgetfulness and your good memory and your poor memory, that doesn't matter. Only thing that matters is the way people are approving and valuing you as if you're in this role of godlike. We call it the MDity complex. And our game is to help our if I were talking to Christie's residents, I would say, what I want you to be doing is to realize that you're a person first and medicine is your special interest. And to help the public and the providers and the carriers and the malpractice carriers, et cetera, to realize, hey, what's the story with the complexity that exists in this situation? That doesn't mean we can't hold somebody to a level of competency and give them feedback and say you're doing well or poorly and looking at the outcomes. But the humanness of the physician, not the doctor as God. Role is filled. I mean, the whole game is God's role is filled. It's just filled.
Well, I'm thinking about how this affects a doctor's patient care, how it affects those relationships one-on-one with a patient if he or she is really stressed and maybe quick to snap or quick to come to judgment or maybe getting sloppy because they're so tired or making, mistakes. How do you see that most commonly play out in terms of early symptoms?
Well, if they're quick to snap, the doctor rarely works on a submarine with nobody else out in the medical domain. There are other people around, even in a submarine. And so you have all these other people around, including patients and family members, but certainly staff and assistants and nurses and business managers to give you feedback on what's going on. So if you get feedback on your curtness or your boundary violation or your forgetfulness or your not signing your signature on a chart or something like that, then feedback gives you a chance to correct and to improve and to realize what there's some issues. And so if I could change one thing in all of medicine today, I would say what we have to change is colleagues, including non-physicians, but particularly physicians, giving each other feedback on the positive professionalism and on the negative professionalism and then doing something about it so it's not just stigmatized. If
so
it's stigmatized, we won't do anything about it.
That are coming out on the internet where patients grade the doctor, but colleague to colleague is what
colleague to colleague. I just saw this. Gee, help me understand what was going on. Not criticizing, not judging them. I just saw this. What's going? Give them a chance to reflect on the context of this situation. Do you realize what that could mean or what the consequences are, how that could be perceived? Or wait a second, you were so fast. Maybe there's an error of omission or commission, or you were quick to, you said quick to judge. Quick to judge is very scary because you never know when something else comes out. You forgot to ask about new eye drops, which had mercury in it, and that produced a problem, et cetera, et cetera. So peer feedback is kind of everything in relationships, because peer feedback occurs in relationships if they are trusting. The nature of the way we trained our docs is to not trust our colleagues, not trust our attendings, not trust our nurses, and vice versa. So there's this whole defensiveness that keeps you so compulsive and uptight, if you don't mind, that,
and isolated,
that we lose.
As you said.
And that's what got to me. What got to me was the isolation, and then they poured their heart out to me, and I realized, wow, nobody seems to understand what's going on, what we're asking them to do. I had a case where my mother, whose net was just 102, was being seen by a doctor at a local academic medical center. And the resident came in first before the attending came in. And the resident was obvious to me that he was just about ready to pass out. I had him sit in a chair. I put my coat over it. I locked the door from the inside. I said, take 5 minutes before the attending comes. He won't be able to get in. When the door starts opening up, I will wake you up. Because there's no way he could take care of my mother, my own mother, when his eyes could barely stay open.
Wow.
We're going to be talking with Dr. John Henry Pfifferling. And in our remaining time, let me just ask one question. If you had three wishes, you're the genie there, and you're granting three wishes, and probably trying to prevent some of this. I know you do a lot of work into prevention.
I do.
What would be the three wishes that ultimately we all know, if they're granted, will probably really dramatically improve professional and physician well-being and ultimately patient well-being?
I think quickly answering a very good and tough and complicated question, Adam, I think number one, we would become much more expert at giving and receiving feedback. That's constructive feedback. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two, I think we'd really look at perfectionism and the dark side of perfectionism and how this produces a person who is just tormented. And then with access and with pressure to not be a god versus a real person, they then cope ineffectively. So I think perfectionism is something we must deal with. And I think three, Christy, I think, mentioned it, is to accept that mistakes are ubiquitous, and there's no such thing as a stupid question. And it's okay to say, I don't know. And then to teach the public more their own assertiveness to ask questions and to expect good answers to those questions. And if it wasn't a good answer, I don't really understand.
Well, common sense, but it's intuitively obvious, but it doesn't sound intuitively easy. Thank you so much for the work that
you've
been doing for a long time to improve physician well-being, Christy, myself, our colleagues, and the public.
And
thank
patients.
You.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr.
Thank you so much. Bye.
We've been talking with the director for the Center of Professional Well-Being, Dr. John Henry Pfifferling. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
You can send us questions that you'd like us to answer to yourhealth@unc.edu. Or you can call us at 966-8081. And let's find out what our very first house call question from our listeners are today.
I have a bunion on the top of my left foot, and I'm wondering what I can do about it. It's painful.
Bunions. Well, I'm glad you know what it is, because so many people are concerned when they have that bump or like hard part on their foot that's hurting them are concerned about what it is. So it sounds like you've already figured that out.
And you know what we call that, Christy? And the real fancy medical term is called hallux valgus or hallux abducto valgus. They're common terms for a big bump or a bunion around the joint at the base of usually the big toe.
And it sounds like you're wanting to know what you can do about it, and I'm sorry that it's painful to you. There are a bunch of recommendations that we make. There's not a lot of evidence that they make a big difference, but it's worth trying.
Yeah, you know, one of the big problems is that it's irritating sometimes when you get this bump that's irritated, and when you walk, it's painful, and it can get red, and then ultimately sometimes the toes can kind of start changing their alignment. So a lot of the times, you have to make some accommodation in your footwear so that you don't have that redness and tenderness.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing is changing your shoes, thinking about some sort of padding and shielding from that area so you're not pressing on it, resting it, maybe giving it some ice if it's swollen, and maybe some anti-inflammatory medications may also help the discomfort.
And sometimes you may want to see a physician that specializes in shoe wear. There's who does a lot of work with orthotics. Some physical therapists will do that. You might have to see an orthopedist.
Or a podiatrist.
Even a podiatrist that can maybe do a little bit of both. That's right. Well, that's hopefully helpful to you. And let's find out, Christy, what is our very next house call?
This is Ron. I had a question about supplements. I recently started taking again glucosamine and chondroitin, and it made me wonder, is it important to discuss with your physician at the time of your visit or at your physical what things other than prescription meds you're taking, such as supplements?
Thank you for asking this question, because absolutely, our recommendation for all of you is to please talk to your physician when you go in. Tell your doctor everything you're taking, all of your supplements. Just bring them with you if you need to, because there can be interactions with other medications from your supplements, and it may be an opportunity to ask your doctor if it's worth spending your money on it, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's actually what's interesting, Christy, to me, is the question here is implies that you, our listener Ron here, was hesitant to maybe say it. Maybe they didn't think that it was worthwhile. Maybe they were scared the physician would tell them not to. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why you're having this question here. And all of them are the sorts of things we really want to talk about. We assume that we want to know about the side effects, but you know, maybe it's you were scared that you think it helps you, and does the physician going to respect you?
Well,
and that's important to know.
Even if your doctor, I mean, your doctor's going to give you advice one way or another, but ultimately you're in charge of your health. So it's still worth a conversation. And your doctor may say, or I might say to you, that, okay, there's some studies suggesting that it may not be helpful. But
in this case, that's some of the research shows.
So, Ron,
we do want to let you know that we're not so keen on it. But, you know, on the other hand, you probably do have opinions, and those are important.
And if it helps you, and then it might be worth it. So, yes, talk to your doctor about all the supplements
you're taking. And the side effect of glucosamine that we've talked about in the past is it can act a little bit as a blood thinner. So if you are on other blood thinners, including aspirin or Advil or those kinds of things, be aware it can interact.
Okay, let's do our next house call.
I would like to know if interval training helps with weight loss.
Well, that's a really good question. And I think perhaps we should start off by defining what is interval training. It's obvious our listener here in their house call knows what it is, but have you done interval training, Christy? Is that something you're doing?
Workout? I shouldn't reveal how little I'm working out these days. I'll get back to it in tennis season, I hope. But yeah, a little too personal I tell people to exercise every day. So
I was actually doing some. I've been on an elliptical machine recently, and they have when you can program your elliptical machine the type of workout you do, and one of them is intervals.
Well, this is the only way I know about this.
You're doing it. All of a sudden, you have to increase the pace that you're doing, and your heart rate goes up, and the strength goes up. And it's difficult for the minute or two that you're doing this interval.
Well, and I like it on the elliptical or even, you know, on a bike where you're going fast for just a little while and then you have a little break and then you go fast again. And for me, it's easier to do it fast for a little bit of time than to try to keep up that pace for a longer period of time.
But this question of helping with weight loss is a really good question. And I was a little bit dubious about it. And so I looked at some articles that are actually published on it, and it does appear that there's something to this that, you know, this short duration, high intensity interval training does have impacts on weight and weight loss more so than just the regular. Now, that may be because you're burning more calories, but it also appears to happen at a little bit of a cellular level with insulin in what happens in the changes in our bodies that actually can perhaps help us lose weight.
Yeah, I'm not sure we fully understand how it works, but from my perspective, if that's the thing that helps you either be more excited about exercise or to be able to get your heart rate up and work out harder, you know, when you think about the sum of the time that you're at that higher rate, then it's worth it.
Yeah, because part of it is you do get this in more calories, but you also have a higher aerobic capacity with this interval training, which has some effects on fitness. So thank you so much for that question. We encourage folks to do their fitness and maybe do interval training if you haven't tried it before.
Well, I'm going to be more likely to choose that interval option when
we're
I get on the
We're
going
to hold you to it, Christy.
All right.
What's our very next house call question?
When should someone purchase a medical alert bracelet to wear? And how often should they wear the medical alert bracelet or necklace?
Medical alert bracelets. Well, that's a great question. And maybe it's one that we don't think about enough because so many people have conditions that others need to know about.
Yeah, and certainly if you have a condition where you might either fall and not be able to get up or you might pass out and not be able to get help, then a medical alert bracelet can really be helpful. There's a good website I can direct you to. It's called www.ehow.com. And if you search in there medical alert bracelets, you'll find, really helpful tips and information about it.
Yeah, the pros, and there's not too many cons. And, it reminds me, Christy, when I was out biking in New Bern at the Muscular Dystrophy Bike-a-thon last year, I came across someone who had fallen and, they were having a little bit of difficulty breathing. And I said, oh, I suspect you're on a blood thinner. And they said, how did you know? Well, I was like, well, I was joking, but that's the physician nightmare. And then I said, I suspect you're diabetic too. They said, how did you know that too? And I'm like, oh my goodness. And the reality is how much easier would it have been if they had a medical alert bracelet? But these bracelets are not, they're for all kinds of conditions. If you have a heart implant, if you have an organ, if you have seizures, diabetes, you're on multiple drugs, someone may have dementia and you wouldn't know it. Tons of conditions out there for which it might be helpful.
And it gives, the medical providers that information that they need to be able to take care of you at that moment. So certainly something to consider.
Well, Christy, we've had a good chance here today on House Calls to really talk about some common things that affect people, a lot of people, things like bunions and getting really good care and foot care.
About medical alert bracelets.
About interval training, something that we're going to hold Christy to. Find out how she's doing.
And about talking to your doctor about the supplements that you're taking. So thank you for asking your questions and for being with us today. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you. And we want you to share your questions and any stories you may have by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Call us at 919-966-8081.
Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or go to Twitter, Your Health Radio. Give us your comments about the show today and let us know what you're thinking.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, and our guest today, Dr. John Henry Pfifferling.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.